And then it's as we're in that process that will help them relearn really healthy behaviors that actually do honor their employees, that do create an environment. And then for them to have the penny drop, it's like, oh, wow, these survival-based lying, protecting myself behaviors actually don't get me to the very capitalistic goals I want to get to. And so we begin to open the door to a more conscious way of being.
Welcome to the Mindspace podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. My guest today is Michael Bunting. Michael is a consultant with a focus on mindfulness in the workplace. He's the founder of The Mindful Leader, an online resource for developing mindful leadership skills, and Work Smart Australia, a leadership consultancy. He's also the author of The Mindful Leader, a practical guide to mindfulness meditation. His consulting work focuses on culture transformation in organizations, and he's had success with some very well-known companies, including Novartis, Qantas, Hilton Hotels, and Rio Tinto. Mindfulness training is at the core of his services, and this work draws on his decades-long practice in insight meditation. Michael and I spoke about the importance of mindfulness in changing culture in organizations, how mindfulness consulting actually works, how to bring mindfulness into the workplace with ethics and integrity, leaders' roles in creating culture that promotes mental health and well-being, the importance of honesty and respect in an organization's health, the most important characteristics of great leaders, the connection between mindfulness, self-awareness, and behavioral change, and how organizations should approach remote work. Of all the people I've spoken to over the years about mindfulness in the workplace, I must say I find Michael Bunting has probably the best balance of a real concrete, real-world understanding of how organizations work on the ground and a deep appreciation and insight into how mindfulness meditation works. And so I really think this is the reason why he's having so much success, and I'm really happy for him and hope he continues to have success. And I hope you find his analysis of mindfulness in the workplace to be as interesting and insightful as I did. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Michael Bunting.
So, Michael Bunting, welcome to the podcast.
Great to be with you, Joe.
All right. We've been trying to set this up for a while. I'm glad we finally made it happen. And of course, the time zones and all that added to the challenge. You're in Sydney, right? Or is it Melbourne?
In Sydney, Australia, yeah.
All right. So morning for you, evening for me.
Yeah.
Let's jump right into it. Maybe you could just start by telling us what you do and what your background is to the work that you're doing these days.
It's funny, Joe, you ask. I'm constantly asked that question. I've been meeting a lot of new people recently, not in my field. And I go, well, the simple explanation is I run training programs in the field primarily of leadership development. That's the, you know, like you go into a classroom and you learn a day or and so on. The more complex answer is whole culture change. So typically a client will come to us, a big corporation typically will come to us and say, our culture needs to change. We will then usually ask, well, what are the two most problematic behaviors in your culture? And what are the two behaviors you'd love to change? Usually clients get blank at that point. They haven't defined that for themselves. And then we begin a journey that typically lasts anything between 1 and 4 years. And it involves creating a structure for behavior change in the senior leadership of an organization aligned with the culture they want. And it usually involves a ton of work in the area of mindset and behavior within the leaders. And there's processes and assessments and all of that. So it's a range of things. But if you had to keep it simple, it's about helping an organization move from X behaviors to Y behaviors that then will lead to better mental health for their employees, better financial outcomes, more efficiency, a whole range of basically what you would call culture improves.
Okay, so again, you sticking with the sort of simple answer, you identify primarily as a consultant then?
Yeah, we actually, just the other day, we had this discussion, you know, because we traditionally come from a training and development background, where we're training and developing executive senior leaders. But the more and more we look at our work, it is consulting. We're probably spending 80% of our time in design, meeting, consulting phase, and 20% in actual delivery, you know, delivering programs.
Okay. And then you do teach, as far as I understand, a lot of mindfulness in these training programs. I wonder how you would describe the relationship between mindfulness practice and the sort of more scaled challenge of culture change.
Yeah. So, and that's the really the million-dollar question. And so I'll try and keep this relatively short because it's a really big answer. The first piece is that I don't believe it's really viable to introduce mindfulness as a subject on its own for its own sake to an organization. It doesn't fit in the strategy. It doesn't fit anywhere. It's kind of half mental health and well-being, but it's not a complete strategy on mental health and well-being and energy and movement, you know, the classic sort of Thrive programs or complete sort of wellness programs. Mindfulness is a very important piece, but it's not the whole story. And then equally on the leadership development side, what we've seen a lot of programs where it's, oh, we sell or teach mindful leadership, but really it's just meditation for people in leadership positions, and it's called mindful leadership, which is not really, you know, my view on that is, if I teach you to meditate, does that make you a better swimmer? It's like, maybe, but I don't think so. You might be a calmer swimmer. And the assumption that if we teach people mindfulness, they will become better leaders is a false assumption in my view. So what we tend to do, what we've learned over the years, as I said earlier before we started recording, this is year 20 for us on teaching and presenting and facilitating on mindfulness in corporations. So we started doing it long before it was cool. We realized very quickly that organizations, what you call legislate for is a behavior change. So if I'm an organization and I go, I want more of this behavior, whether that be simple things like honesty or respect of its values, for example, we can go to the organization and say, all right, great. So let's create accountability for those behaviors. Good. Now, what are the conditions or training or whatever we can do to support your people to be able to master those behaviors? And that's where mindfulness comes in. Mm-hmm. So we've got a funny saying we say to our clients usually, we're going to teach you mindfulness, we're going to present mindfulness right throughout our work, and we can come to why that's in a minute. But it's not a mandatory thing. If standing on your head, drinking Coca-Cola upside down would help you master, you know, more respectful behavior or more honest behavior, do that. It just turns out that mindfulness is probably the most efficient, structured way to develop the level of self-regulation you need to actually master those behaviors that you're being asked to do now for the organization. So we see mindfulness is a super important foundational background practice. It's not a practice. It's a means to the end. It's not the end itself in a corporate context. In a personal context, it's the end itself.
Yeah, there's a lot in there I'd like to ask you about. Something caught my attention right off the top, and it may be super obvious, but I can also, I'm really curious. When you get a call from an organization to change culture, you very quickly jumped into talking about developing leadership or changing leadership. I'm wondering, I guess my initial assumption might have been, well, for changing culture, why wouldn't it start sort of from a grassroots or just ordinary members of an organization coming together and changing things more organically? Why does culture change automatically involve leadership development?
It's really simple. Leaders determine a culture. So if a leader is not being honest, then the culture loses its honesty very, very quickly. You can see this in global leadership terms. There might be rebellious grassroots movements against that poor leadership. Often you don't get it against great leadership, but it's what, you know, there's a saying in leadership, what you walk past is what you tolerate is what you're agreeing with. And leaders set the tone they're just unfortunately, leadership is a term, is there's a lot of varying opinions of what it means. It means it's an activity, it's a position, and so on and so on. But ultimately, you know, if you're, for example, if your CEO in an organization is willing to be vulnerable and talk about the need for vulnerability and psychological safety, that has far bigger impact than a frontline employee talking about vulnerability and psychological safety. I'm not saying that the frontline employee is not, they're equally as important. It's just about impact. Mm-hmm. So in ancient Ireland, I lived in Ireland for a while, they used to have this punishment system, like the more senior you were in the culture, in the society, the harsher your punishment was for a crime that affected society. And it was like this recognition that the further up you go in terms of the power structures, the bigger the impact is of that good or negative behavior. So we found if you don't shift the leadership, you've got no chance of shifting the culture. And that's one of the great challenges of mindfulness movements. If you come in with a mindfulness movement at mid-level in an organization, the best you're ever going to get is supporting people individually in the context of their work in an organization. We've never seen a successful shift in an organization's way of being, if you will, if you to take that collectively, without involvement in senior leadership. Maybe it's out there, we've just never seen it.
Okay, that's interesting. So another kind of big question for you. I'm curious what kind of mandates you've been getting over the many years, you know, in terms of culture change. How do organizations want to change their culture? And then the part two to that is, how has it changed since the global pandemic hit a few months ago?
Yeah. I mean, the first question is a massive question. So So let me just try and zero it down, and that as your listeners can maybe relate to this in their own experience. We've tried to boil all of our work down over the years. We're very committed to simplicity. So simplicity, mindfulness practice is very simple, but it's also very challenging and sophisticated. What we've come down to is there's two primary behaviors we see in organizations that if are not addressed, that the culture has no opportunity of genuine change. And they are accountability and honesty. So if you take it at a team level or even your personal relationship or marriage, one of the two telltale signs we see of a team or a company that's not healthy is they are missing honesty with each other and they're missing personal accountability. And if those two are not addressed, nothing changes. And in terms of, I'll just start with the honesty piece. In the average organization, people are profoundly dishonest with each other. And it's not because they're bad people at all. It's because it's scary to be honest. And honesty, we think of as addressing behavior that's not working, about sharing my views on work, about sharing my views of I'm a leader, even sharing my views on a person's career prospects honestly. Often leaders don't even do that. And then the other aspect is sharing my mistakes, sharing my vulnerabilities, sharing my fears is another aspect of honesty. And I think one of my personal heroes, Marshall Rosenberg, who invented nonviolent communication, he said corporations are the least emotionally safe environments on earth. And he's a guy who worked in war zones. And I agree with that. I mean, I haven't worked in war zones, but I agree. I've never seen a more psychologically unsafe environment than corporations. And when we tell the truth, we're often caught with a dilemma where I'm going to tell the truth and break my relationships or alienate people, or I'm going to go for kind of a fake harmony and be nice, but cover up the truth. That creates an incredible level of distrust. And then it creates all kinds of secondary behaviors, like constantly trying to prove yourself, constant anxiety, cross-questioning, political behavior. There's a whole range of toxic, called quote-unquote toxic behaviors that come rooted in the lack of honesty. There's a huge drive at the moment in most organizations towards this term called psychological safety, because Google did this big study and they discovered that, psychologically safe teams work much better. The people are happier, they produce more, they're more innovative, they're all good things. So we need psychological safety. And psychological safety is typically thought of as you can share your mistakes and you can speak up. Those are the big elements that are typically the hallmarks. In our view, we've come to discover through our direct work with clients that as soon as the leader in the team is not really honest with the team begins second guessing where they stand. And then there's a tremendous amount of anxiety. And we've come to the realization that without honesty, and that means sometimes inconvenient and difficult honesty, people don't know where they stand. If they don't know where they stand, as we know from the brain science, we're negatively inclined in the mind. They'll fill in the blanks with negativity and worry. And then that, again, that's a disaster. We've never come across an organization that's really mastered honesty. And it's subtle. Like one of the questions we'll ask our clients is, so do you ever go home and talk about what colleagues with your loved ones at home, but you don't have the direct conversation with that person at work? Everybody instantly recognizes that. Well, then, and those same people who do that will claim they have integrity. We say, well, that's not integrity at all. Integrity is when what you're thinking and what you're saying and what you're doing are congruent. And let's take a look. And it's there's huge gaps there. The second element's accountability. So a classic we find when we ask organizations, let's say CEO or executive leadership said, we need to change a culture. And we'll say, okay, so what are you doing to make the culture toxic that you want to change? The senior leader, we'll ask them that direct question. They'll usually tell us it's not us, it's the middle management. It's not us who's creating the problem here. It's someone else. And this also pervades in teams, it pervades in relationships, it pervades in our lives. So, you know, you ask a parent, the child is struggling at school, the parent might send the child to a psychologist. But not look at their own behavior. It's like, hold on a second, you're the child's parent. Or you ask a person who's struggling in their marriage, you know, what's going on? Oh, it's my partner needs to change this, change. Well, what's your part in it? Do you have any accountability for the way things? It seems, and you know yourself, Joe, it seems like the last thing people tend to ask is what's my part in this difficulty and how can I change me? And the same issue pervades organizations in even, you know, in sort of an exponential way. So, you know, teams not functioning well, we'll typically interview. So that, let's say it's 10 people, interview those 10 people and we'll say, okay, well, what's created the difficulty in the team? What needs to change? Maybe 0.001% of the time I'll hear someone say, you know what, it's my behavior. I need to change. And if people can't take accountability, nothing can change. And we talk about growth mindset as another big term in corporations. If there's no personal accountability, there's no growth. It's technically impossible because the mind is blaming and rationalizing. So we found in organizations, the two most important things are accountability and honesty. If you get those right, then growth can happen, learning can happen, connection can happen, repairing can happen when difficulties arise, so on and so on and so on.
And what happens when those are not in place? What kind of symptoms arise or what kind of problems do these organizations come to you with?
The biggest, in most recent times, the biggest thing, because we do a lot of work in the adult development space as well. So not just in terms of our mindfulness work is mostly growth oriented, not calming or well-being oriented. It's more like the pointy end of growth or insight practice style. But the most common problem we see in organizations is this term called looking good. And I'll try and give you the logic of it. If I don't know where I stand with my boss, let's say, right? Then how do I make sure I secure my career or secure my income? I'll tend to overdo things. So I'll try and impress the boss all the time. That behavior of trying to impress the boss wastes, I think the estimate is about a third of an average person's energy in an organization is spent towards managing their image in front of us. A third, I mean, it's exhausting, where you're constantly trying to look good and cover up mistakes and, you know, put your best foot forward and perfect that slide deck because just in case you made a typo error. And so the whole work, the workflow, the efficiency of the organization slows down, but also people are feeding a mask. So there's a lack of authenticity. This profound level of anxiety in the organization or in people. And so it's just a simple not knowing where you stand and not having people take ownership tends to result in this constant looking good behavior. The other problem from a development perspective is most, sounds judgmental, but it's, which I'm conscious of as a mindfulness practitioner, the research indicates that most people's values, when I say the research, this is Harvard Adult Development Research, most people's values are not fine and noble values. What's actually, what they're actually being driven by is this desire for approval and economic safety. Mm-hmm. And if you put up against a value like honesty and it happens to conflict with, so if I'm honest, I might threaten my economic survival in the organization or I might look bad. Not, you know, in our experience, 90% of the population will go for the looking good, keeping my job versus honesty. So values are usually a fake promise. I mean, as one client beautifully put it the other day, the values on the wall are different from the values on the floor in our organization. And that's just every organization. Mm-hmm. So a lot of politics, a lot of trying to outshine each other, a lot of dishonesty and a tremendous amount of anxiety in the workplace.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that that has come to the fore in recent years? I mean, I know there's a lot of discussion about the rise in anxiety and burnout and stress. There's a famous Gallup poll that talked about U.S. organizations wasting $300 billion a year from stress-related absences. 7 out of 10 employees report being disengaged from their work. Is this the kind of stuff you're getting into here?
In a sense, our work is designed to address those problems.
Okay.
I mean, probably 80% of what we do is addressing engagement. And mental health is a function aspect of engagement. So on that spirit of what I said earlier around accountability, we became concerned, would probably be the right word, with even the mindfulness movement in corporations being misused. And so, in other words, senior leadership say, look at the data. Our people are not mentally healthy. They're stressed. They're not engaged. We need to give them a mindfulness program. And we started seeing this trend. And that, you know, I hate to admit it, but as a mindfulness practitioner, that angered me. I was frustrated with that. And so we, in part of our research, so we have a leadership model built off the world's most recent. So my first book I wrote was with Jim Kouzis and Barry Posner, and they have the world's most researched leadership model. It's evidence-based, validated, extensively researched, saying this is what you as a leader need to do to support your people to be at their best. I then wrote The Mindful Leader, my second book, which was a building off that model into a bit more deeper mindset work off this well-researched leadership work. And what we did is we were interested in the research between the connection between senior leadership's behavior and people's mental health beneath them. Because we were seeing this trend. It's like, oh, okay, my mental health and my people's not well, give them a mindfulness program. We were like, do you understand, do you appreciate senior leaders that a lot of your mental health challenges in your business is because of your behavior as a leader, as a boss? So we went about researching this and we found, we extensively researched this through 360 assessments and cross-correlation research. And we found that our data showed that a third of a person's mental health could be explained by their boss's behavior. A third. So we were very, very, and 40 something percent of their engagement at work can be explained by their boss's behavior. So it's like, okay, we need to address engagement and we need to address the mental health. And our proposition is, well, you have to start with your senior leadership then. Because if they are behaving in ways that are out of alignment with what we call mindful leadership, and we've got behaviors attached to that, then you're kind of, you're throwing good money after bad. Because it's like, even those of us who have a very strong mindfulness practice, I know I have a very 27-year mindfulness practice. Last year, I had a very, very difficult client. And the client was behaving politically and sabotaging my own work. Not the client, a couple of people in the client. So I shouldn't say that. And I must confess, my mental health declined through the year. It became profoundly difficult to get up and continue engaging with that work when you know that the people you're working with are secretly trying to work against you. And a lot of people experience that in organizations every day. And I don't care how strong your mindfulness practice is, you're going to get affected. And the healthiest option at that point, you know, when I looked back at it, the healthiest option, like a proactive, healthy response would have been to leave, fire the client, walk away. And so for a lot of people in those toxic organizations, when you start practicing well-being and you start reconnecting with yourself, it becomes really obvious you should get out of there. Mm-hmm. And so if an organization's trying to make its help its people become healthy, if it's not addressing the behaviors that are ruling the day in the organization, which is usually determined by the leadership, you really are throwing good money after bad. And it's one of the great frustrations of mindfulness. I hear this over and over and over again from people who teach mindfulness in organizations. It's like there's this feeling, I mean, you might have even mentioned yourself, Joe, it's this feeling of I'm presenting good stuff. I'm presenting beautiful mindfulness programs to a collection of people, but I don't really feel like it's making an impact on the organization. Yeah. It won't make an impact.
So this is really interesting. I wanted to ask you about Ron Purser, whose work I'm guessing you're familiar with, the author of McMindfulness. Just checking with you there, you know who Ron Purser is?
I don't know Ron, but I know what McMindfulness is all about.
I was curious about what he had to say, and he's articulate and thought a lot of this through. His frustration, your arguments overlap to some extent, but what's interesting where you diverge in my view is that you have the same frustration as him, that mindfulness is being used to sort of placate stressed and anxious and burnt out employees who are totally disenfranchised from any kind of sort of decision making or impact on the culture. You're saying it's a bad idea because it simply doesn't work. He's saying it's a bad idea because it's ethically corrupt. And so I'm glad to sort of get that new input. I definitely want to hear more about how you might respond to the notion that it's ethically corrupt. But I personally from my own work teaching organizations, I can resonate with that feeling. And just that there's something, I'm putting something out there that I value a lot, that's precious in a way, and that it's not landing in fertile ground somehow.
Yes.
And I think, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but I don't get the impression there are bad people trying to like ruin their employees' lives. I think everyone's doing their best, but somehow the environment has to be right for the mindfulness to land properly. I don't know if that resonates with you.
It's exactly what we've dedicated the last 15 years of our work is to this particular subject you're talking about. And
is this different from any other sort of technology you bring into a workplace? Or is this really something that's kind of unique to mindfulness because it's so personal and so human as an experience?
I don't think so. I think, you know, I come back to those base principles I talked about earlier, accountability and honesty. It's like as soon as those are missing, no matter what you give the organization, it's going to fail in terms of creating change in the organization because they're so fundamental. It's like you're taking painkillers for cancer. You're not addressing anything for real. And I think, I don't know that the background of the term ethically corrupt, but what we would say was the mindfulness itself can help the individual, but it makes no impact on the culture. And the person will still be going to a toxic workplace every day. And that, in that sense, it's ethically corrupt because it's moving the problem away. It's a lack of accountability. So it's the senior leadership saying, well, let's give them a mindfulness program. And at no point asking the question, what are we doing that's created this difficulty? It didn't happen by magic fairies. I mean, we've got a difficult, people are struggling in our culture. We're the senior leadership. It must be us. It must be something to do with us.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to strawman Ron Purser, and ideally we'd give him a chance to really present his case here. But I think, in his view, what's morally corrupt is things that are built into capitalism to some extent, that the whole system is based on taking advantage of people who are not adequately paid or cared for in their work, and leadership wants to keep that going because that's what makes an organization successful.
Yeah, so I think...
Go ahead.
I've got a pretty strong view on that one. We work inside the trenches with big organizations, and we see exactly what you're saying. We see good people doing bad things. And it's exactly, you know, you think of like the things like World War II, you would have people, you would have German officers doing awful things in the day and then going home and being a loving family member. So when you're in the system can have a heavy impact on you, obviously, right? Yeah. And you can forget yourself in the system and you can act according to the system because you still want to pay your bills. The broader, we don't, in our work, we do not engage in the deeper question around, is the system itself corrupt? You know, right. The whole capitalist system. Because we find when we do that, we arrest our ability to influence. I know it sounds very pragmatic, but if I walk into a client and say, hey, you know, the whole system's corrupt, we need to go to government and change the system, the client be like, okay, well, we need to find another leadership development people.
Not a great sales pitch, yeah.
Yeah. So what we tend to do is we tend to have a very forgiving view that the system is broken. The system is corrupt. How can we help people be their best within that system? That's how we tend to view it. And how can we help them find a personal compass? And if you had to take it by implication, that enough conscious people will then eventually shift the system. But if we're out there as a lone voice trying to shift the system, we don't believe that that's the way. People in power need to shift the system. We're not in power. You know, we're not at the top of big corporations. So our work is much more day-to-day pragmatic, but it's a kind of like what we call skillful means, right? In a Buddhist Dharma practice, it's like we meet the client where they're at and we help them take the next step towards a more consciousness. And that first step is senior leadership taking ownership for their own behavior and their own culture and then constructively working on it. And the good news is it's still allows them to be more profitable because they lose an inordinate amount of money on voluntary staff turnover, on inefficiency, on stress leave. You know, there's a range of things they lose money on. So if we can say to them, our work will improve the outcomes that you're rewarded on, which it does, then they'll be bought in. And then it's as we're in that process that will help them relearn really healthy behaviors that actually do honor their employees, that do create an environment. And then for them to have the penny drop, it's like, oh, wow, these survival-based lying, protecting myself behaviors actually don't get me to the very capitalistic goals I want to get to. And so we begin to open the door to a more conscious way of being. The other critical thing I wanted to say that I'm extremely passionate about is unhitching. So there was a lot of work in the mindfulness field around unhitching mindfulness from compassion practices and how bad that was. Totally agree with that. One of the things that we are not seeing nearly enough is the unhitching of mindfulness with ethics practices. Yep. And we're extremely, extremely passionate about this in our work. So in the leadership context, we will ask senior leaders. We know from the research, from Jim and Barry's research, 30 years, 5 million people in their database on this research, that the number one thing people want from their boss is honesty. And the number one thing they want to know from their boss is what their boss stands for, that the boss walk the talk. When we work with senior leaders, and if you're listening to this right now, think about if you can answer this question. If a leader or a human being is supposed to walk the talk, one would assume they would have a conscious talk that they're trying to walk. They would know what their talk is. And very, very few people we've met actually have that. You say, off the top of your head, what are the two or three values that genuinely shape your decisions in your life? And if you have to think about it, like, let me think about that. It's not shaping your life. As we know, if you're in a mindfulness practice, it's got a quality of deliberateness to it, a quality of consciousness to it, and aliveness in your life. If you're having to think about it, it's not alive. It's dead. If I had to ask you, how can you think about in the last 2 weeks of your life, how did you have a crunch moment, at least one, where you were like, oof, I really want to just protect myself, or I want to just lie, or I just want to get my way. But you know what? Let me refollow my values. Let me follow that value of honesty or that value of respect. Very few people have values as a living practice and a conscious practice. So even defining the talk that you're trying to walk is a massive step for a lot of people. The challenge is if you don't have a values ethics practice, a value that if and when cultivated within yourself and outside of yourself creates harmony within and harmony without, a mindfulness practice is a total waste of time. Mm-hmm. We can't say that strongly enough. Mindfulness has many, many uses, but it's one of its most important uses is creating inner congruence or inner harmony, being able to see the things that the mind is up to that is creating aversion or conflict or ill will, and being able to address it. If you deeply do treasure, for example, honesty, but you're not living honestly, you're not speaking the truth, your mind is going to be in severe conflict. And the only way you can deal with that conflict is by numbing yourself, is by going dead to yourself. Because as soon as you enliven yourself with a practice like mindfulness, you're going to start progressively feeling uncomfortable in yourself. Like there's a dissonance running around in your body and mind. And then we hear, this comes out of people's mouths, oh, mindfulness practice is not for me. It's just, you know, uncomfortable. It's like, I'm not really good at it. We'll more often than not say, ah, oh, that's a red flag that you're not living congruently with your values.
This is all very familiar to me. I often talk to my clients about alignment between values and actions exactly in this way. And yeah. one of the kind of interesting traps or complexities that I end up falling into is that we live in secular societies, in a secular age, where we're not really supposed to be prescribing values to our clients or to organizations. That, you know, there's this sort of sense like everyone can sort of work it out for themselves, and then our job is to sort of help create alignment. But of course, if you take your mindfulness practice deep enough and understand the Buddhist roots to some extent, you end up tending towards some basic principles of ethics, right? So like, as you say, honesty is one, compassion is another one. And so I'm constantly trying to navigate the sort of like moral relativism of our age with some evidence, whether it's from sort of traditional sort of wisdom practice or even some science about the value of like self-transcending values as an example. Like we know that people with self-transcending values are happier. And so how do you navigate this, walk this tight, this fine line between like really wanting to people to pick up the right values for their well-being or the well-being of the organization, but also wanting to preserve autonomy to let people work it out for themselves?
Yeah. In our field, it's one of the reasons why we, and I don't know, some part of me predicts that the mindfulness industry will slowly, like we've just been beaten up by so many bad experiences over so many years. We've learned our lessons, and we're seeing so many of my colleagues and associates they seem to be in the thick of some of the lessons that we were stuck in ourselves a decade ago. It's like we just couldn't get out of them. And which is one of the reasons why we ended up really focusing in on senior leadership in our work, because the values argument is a non-argument in the leadership research. So in the leadership research, no one's arguing that the number one thing they want from their boss is honesty. That's just so, it's been researched globally, hundreds of thousands of people in that research. It's culture, it transcends culture. So it's like if you were a research evidence-based person, you could not argue that honesty is not important as a leader. It's not an argument. The second aspect, the second most important value in leadership is respect, treating people with dignity and respect. That two base level values of honesty and respect are just unarguable. Like, so when we present our content to leaders and we go, so if we had to create a basic benchmark for each one in this room, and you find your own expression of that, what is honesty and what does respect mean to you? And where are you out of alignment with that? And take them through a very deep journey, which we do. We take them through a 2 or 3 year journey. Just around those two values, they become, there's not a debate, if you will, that same debate. You're to, oh no, do we have the right? Well, you're in a leadership position. The quality of your leadership, the levels of trust, et cetera, matter. We all agree, yes, good. Then, well, that's not an option. You have to master those two. Because look, here's what the data shows. It shows people disengage as soon as you don't treat them with respect. Disengage as soon as you don't treat them with honesty. And when they disengage, their mental health suffers and the organizational performance suffers. And this is where the capitalistic model serves us. Because ultimately, we can always make the economic argument. If you do not do honesty and respect well, it's going to cost your business money over time.
So I'm curious to kind of get a little bit more of a concrete feel for how you do the work that you do and how mindfulness is integrated into it. So my understanding is that a client approaches you with a need around cultural transformation. You try to bring that down to like behavioral outcomes. And then what, you're designing training programs and what else? And like, are you actually meditating with people in boardrooms? Like, how does that all fit together?
Yeah, okay, great. So I'm just going to use a recent example because take you through the live process. So a client comes to us, change the culture. They define their culture in three key values they wanted to develop. But what they hadn't done at that point is, which a lot of organizations haven't done, they hadn't defined it in terms of behavior. And we know that if you're going to get that honesty and accountability and growth, it has to be concrete, it has to be defined. So our typical first job is to help the client define their aspirations in terms of behavioral outcomes. With this particular client, they asked us to develop a 360 assessment for them that defined these behaviors. We then used all of our, because we've got this wonderful background of heavily researched behaviors around outcomes on engagement, mental health, performance, all of those things that companies want. In this example, we ended up adding a fourth category called self-awareness, which was a leadership category. So they had four buckets of behaviors, and we put 10 behaviors under each of those buckets. Now, that's a lot of behaviors, 40 behaviors there. And remember, we advocate only one or two behavior changes for the org. So what we then do is connect those behaviors to core, like, so let's, for example, say the company wants to be more innovative. We would say, okay, so for an organization to be more innovative, you need psychological safety, you need open-mindedness, you need rituals, you need innovation rituals, there's a range of things you need. So what we need, though, let's start with psychological safety. What needs to occur for psychological safety? Well, as soon as you get into the leadership side of it, it's complex, because I might be, take an example, Joe, let's say I'm highly task-driven and I'm not relationship-centric. I'm just all about doing the tasks and getting the numbers right. And you, let's say, are more defaulted towards being, you know, taking time and developing good relationships with your team and so on and so on. Our challenges to create psychological safety will be different, because mine will be more about creating quality relationships with my people, just building some warmth. So I might need to really begin to master a value of respect, let's say, and kindness, to humanize myself. Because it doesn't matter if people think I'm telling the truth, but they don't like me, they can't connect with me, there's no psychological safety. You, on the other hand, might be someone who tends to sacrifice the truth for being nice. So your practice is completely different to mine. You have to be more honest and more direct to create more psychological safety. And because human beings are complex, you know, there's a range of behaviors, and it might be we've got 40 people, and those 40 people need to do 40 different behaviors to move the dial towards psychological safety. So we create structure, but also flexibility. Then who determines? So once we've done that, we now have a measurement. We have a baseline way of measuring leaders on some key competencies or behaviors in leaders, and that those behaviors are aligned with the cultural aspiration of the company. We assess the leaders, so all their direct reports, assess them and gives them a score, basically, on how they're doing. And then through that, we zero in on one behavior change for them. Why one? Because Harvard research shows you can only master one behavior change in 12 months. And we've intuited that over the years of our work as well. Keep it simple, but then go deep behind that. Then we use immunity to change maps. So it's kind of shadow work beneath. And we do all this very deep work behind it. That's where mindfulness comes in. So, and by the way, we remeasure typically every 3 months. So if you're in one of our programs, you're getting remeasured on your behavior every 3 months. Objectively. So there's a certain degree of pressure for you to do the work and accountability, but there's also a lot of support. So we work on the basis that change, growth happens. I'd love to hear your view on this as well, but because we don't see ourselves as in the field of helping a person heal and psychologically recover. Although that's an important element in the background of work, it's not why we're there. We are there developmentally. In other words, we tend to think of our work as taking a normal functioning person into real psychological growth and development. That's our work in that area. Mm-hmm. And so what are the ideal conditions for growth? We simplify it as when the level of pain of staying the same is higher than the pain of change, then people will change. So we try and artificially recreate that. So if I'm in this organization and I realize, whoops, if I keep on behaving disrespectfully, which I've gotten away with the last 3 years, I'm not going to survive this company, then that's painful. I don't want to be fired. So, okay, we've got the pain point in place now. And then the second question was, but how do I master behaving respectfully? And that's our job, right? That's what we hired for, to help that leader. Well, here's how you do it. And here's all the mindsets work. Here's all the growth work. Here's all the support tools that you can begin to practice that will support you to master respectful behavior or honest behavior or whatever it is. And mindfulness is so central to that because we, in our work, because it's developmentally oriented, we have my three favorite questions which we ask reliably to our clients to get them to realize that they don't know the answer to this and that mindfulness is the answer to this. So the first question we ask is, remember, we're usually in a leadership context, is self-awareness important for leadership? No one disagrees with that anymore. Now, again, there's a ton of research that shows it's the X factor of great leaders. Great leaders are self-aware. Good. We established that. The second question I ask is, what is self-awareness? Mm-hmm. And Joe, you'd be shocked at people really struggle with that question. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, what exactly is it? We all assume we need it. We're very quick to point out when other people are not self-aware. But have we even asked the question, what is it? And I'll do this in big keynote talks. I'll ask an audience of 500, and you never really get a satisfactory answer. You know, you get things like it's your impact on others, it's some kind of emotional intelligence, it's being able to sort of see yourself or think about yourself, but it's not technically accurate. And then the third question.
Well, are you going to answer that one for us, or are you going to leave us in our ignorance?
I'll answer that because the third question is the deal breaker maker, because it is the answer, but it's also a very practical question. The third question, if people think they've got the second question, I'll ask the third question, which is, okay, so, you know, if I had to say, pick up your phone right now, you would say, and you were clueless, and you said, well, how would I pick up your phone? So in my case, it's on my left side now. I'd say, well, lift your left arm, move it across over the phone, lower your hand onto it, and then grab the phone with your fingers, tighten them around, and then lift it back up. That's how you lift a phone up, right? In really pragmatic directions. If I had to say to you, be self-aware right now, practice it. Be self-aware right now. What would you do to be self-aware right now? Now, you would know this answer, Joe, because it's our field. But now I must have asked, I don't know, 20, 30,000 people this question over a decade. And I'd say maybe one or two people have actually answered this question out of 20,000, I say. It's a very difficult question to answer. When people can't answer that question, I'll say, let's just rewind the implications of this. You've said self-awareness is crucial for leadership. You're all leaders, but none of you know how to actually do it as a practice. It's a theory on in a book somewhere. It's a figment of your imagination, but it's not a practice. You don't know how to do it. Like, it's like in the scenario of the phone that I said earlier, you'd have to go and read a book or do some reflection on how to pick up a phone. Just pick the phone up. Just be self-aware right now. Mm-hmm. And this is where the four foundations of mindfulness come into their own. It's like we would say it's technically impossible to be self-aware without mindfulness. It's like trying to swim without water. You can't do it. Qualifying that mindfulness is a natural quality in us. It's not, you know what I mean? When we're cultivating mindfulness, it's not like we didn't have it. We're just enhancing it and growing it. If you weren't naturally mindful, you couldn't walk. You couldn't drive a car. So everyone's naturally mindful, but to cultivate it deliberately, and to that deliberateness is what self-awareness is all about. So the answer, the technically correct answer is, so self-awareness, the first part of that is aware, two words, aware and self. What is awareness? We know from mindfulness practice, I'm only aware of something when I'm present to it. If I'm not present to it, it disappears out of my awareness. So there's a door behind me right now. That door doesn't exist unless I turn around and look at it. So while I'm not aware of it, it's just not there. So,
or you can think about it and it'll exist again.
I can think, well, I know I'm thinking about an echo of it. It doesn't exist. I'm not awaring the door. I am thinking about the door, and that's different. So one's a real experience, it's live. The other is an echo, an imagination. So if I'm not awaring, if I'm not present and awaring, I'm not aware of it at that moment. Full stop, end of story. What is mindfulness? Mindfulness is the cultivation of continuous awaring. That's what it is. You know, it's maintaining awareness. It's growing the capacity to maintain awareness. So without that development of mindfulness, self-awareness development it's like swimming without water. It's not possible, which is astonishing to me in our field that this has not been realized for some reason. Like we teach mindfulness for calming, or people will say, how do you be self-aware? You follow your breath. That's a kind of element, but that's not the gist of it. The gist of it is be mindful. And then the next question is, what's self? So if I'm going to be mindful, which is about being continuously aware, not like a strobe light where I have these brief moments of awareness, which is what's most people's attentions like, but I've got a continuous awareness, because when I'm continuously aware, it gives me the capacity to learn and see what's really going on. Without that continuous awareness, I'm seeing life like in the strobe light flashes. I'm not actually there, growing and learning and seeing accurately. So first aspect is, which is why in mindfulness practice, calming the mind and stabilizing the mind is so fundamental. Unfortunately, in our context, what we see over and over again is that's how mindfulness is taught. That's the end of it. If you've calmed and stabilized the mind, you're mindful. And we're like, no, you've now established the foundation to do the development work. Mm-hmm. The second aspect is, what is self? So if I'm aware, what am I awaring? What am I awaring? And then it gets really, really basic. It's like, well, there's the body. I can aware the body. Okay. Does the body have messages for me? Yes, millions of messages. So when I'm out of congruence with my values, for example, does my body let me know? Oh, yes, it does. And you'll feel it immediately. When my intention is ill, when I've got an ill intent, I want to hurt someone. Does my body let me know? Yes. But very few people have learned to listen, to be mindful in that and trust the body's wisdom. So that's the first foundation of self, is a body. The second is noticing your reactivity to your experience. So that's the second element of self. It's like, I might say, I might look out the window and I see the sun shining, and then I'll notice, oh, I've got like this reaction to the sun shining. So my body might feel relaxed when I see the sun, and then there might be like an attitude that I notice of openness or closedness, for example, or wishing it was there or glad it's there. So you can begin to notice your reaction to your experience. That's the second element of self. The third element of self, which we do a lot of focus on, is the narrative of the mind, which you guys do a lot of as well in your work. It's like, be mindful of what the mind is storytelling? What is it up to? What is it judging? What is it doing? And then can I ask the question, notice, is this serving me? Is this helping me become the person I want to be? And if I'm not awaring the body or awaring the attitude or awaring the mind, I'm not being self-aware. Full stop, end of story. Like I got stressed it strong enough. Like we might want to imagine that self-awareness is something else, but how could it possibly be anything other than that? And it's a completely lost. So the idea of teaching self-awareness without mindfulness, particularly a developmental style of mindfulness, and I should qualify, what we mean by developmental style of mindfulness is technique-wise, following my breath, for example, we would call that a concentration practice. It's not a developmental mindfulness practice. So what can happen is, okay, if you're meditating and you're following the breath and some sadness arises in your system, like in your body or your heart or your mind, the practice in a concentration practice is you kind of ignore it and you just stay with the breath and you keep calming the mind. That long-term can lead to problems. That can lead to repression and suppression, which it did for me. My first 10 years of mindfulness practice, I mean, I practiced every day. I meditated an hour every day without fail for 10 years. I was disciplined. And I ended up repressed and depressed because the practice was a concentration practice only. It wasn't an insight developmental practice. The developmental practice is if I notice sadness, I then let that become my interest. I let my mindfulness follow that. You know, and I become, that's much more psychologically integrated because I'm not now repressing. But also it is what self-awareness is. I become, you know, it's the heart of curiosity. I become interested in what does sadness feel like? Can I bear it? Can I be with it? Now I'm developing psychological maturity because I'm actually able to sit with pain instead of reacting out of it and so on and so on. So when we teach mindfulness in corporations, we teach it for the purposes of growth and development, growth mindset. And we teach an insight developmental style of mindfulness practice. And the predominant method we use for that, apart from, you know, the typical data research neuroscience stuff, is our app. So we have a ton of development structure and processes in the app because, again, you're in the problem where you give people a beautiful practice, but they've got no resource. Mm-hmm. They've got no way to practice ongoing. And so we've spent the last 3 years developing this app, which it's like with all apps, you know, we're kind of proud of what we've done, but we also not happy. So we are developing a massive upgrade this year so that people have structure. This is the other thing as well with mindfulness. It's like if you go into the internet and you're trying to learn mindfulness, it's you know, it's like a zoo. It's just crazy. And so we try and give people structure. And we have a view that if your most important question in mindfulness is, why am I practicing? The how, we can give you all of that in the app. But our job in the mindfulness space in corporates is to help people understand, why would you even do this? Mm-hmm. Like, why would I sit down and meditate for 5 minutes? Like, what's the point? I'm calm enough.
This is a really interesting question to me, and one I've been wrestling with for a while. I think that the mandate we get in a clinical setting is pretty clear. People want to heal, people want to feel better, they want to feel less anxious or stressed or depressed or whatever. But that doesn't last very long as a motivating force because it's not a direct line. It's not easy to see how these practices that you're doing that you need to find the discipline to do are how you just keep doing them, you'll cross the finish line of wellness at some point.
Yeah.
And it's not clear. And of course, you know, I operate primarily in the sort of MBSR context where it's not overtly or explicitly Buddhist. So we can't appeal to the way Buddhism frames mindfulness meditation. And so we end up, as soon as we sort of kind of reach that why question, it becomes very complex for people for us to answer. And you've got it relatively well framed in the organization because it comes down to, you know, aligning everyone in the deepest possible way to working together successfully.
Joe, we've also got the progress principle built into our work as well. So we introduced on our mindfulness app about 3 months ago the ability to measure your behavior weekly. Mm-hmm. So, because we know there's a strong evidence that when people experience a sense of progress, that they keep going. Mm-hmm. And it's hard in the behavior change field to know how you're progressing. It's very subjective and so on. But where you nominate one or two behaviors that you're working on, and they're tangible and observable. Mm-hmm. And then you keep your other practices going to support that. And then every week or 2 weeks, you get this graph that shows how you did compared to the last assessment. And so it's very defined. Yeah. So that you can feel that sense of concreteness of you going forwards or backwards in the eyes of those around you.
Sure. So again, are you working sort of individual meetings with these leaders? You bring them together for mindfulness like workshops, you going on retreat with people? How are you teaching all of this?
Yeah, all of the above. At the moment, all virtual. So we do, typically we scene set with group work. So we do group, like, you know, we have a 1 day mindfulness program. Remember, our mindfulness programs as a general rule, are presented as a self-awareness day. They're not presented as a mindfulness day. And they present it in the context of supporting the person to self-regulate the behaviors that they want to master, because they have now answered the question to themselves, for themselves and their team, that if I do this behavior more, it will make my life and everyone else's life better. So that's that clarity. That's pre-answered already by the time we come into the mindfulness day. We teach a one-day mindfulness program. We segue them into the use of the app for continued practice and the assessing on the behavior that they're working on. And then there's typically a regular follow-up meeting. So even if we just pure kind of doing mindfulness training in a broader context, we typically do an 8-week process where we meet with them every 2 weeks for an hour and a half. And it's a check-in on how their practice is going and answering. We might introduce a few little extra nuances about the practice as we go. So for example, we might introduce the idea of following the body and being body aware in the first big training. And then the second follow-up, we might begin to broach the subject of feelings in the body. Mm-hmm. So that when we say, I feel sad, that sadness is an physical experience. So I begin to learn that, and then they go off and do more practices. And then we might go to the mind. So this kind of builds, one builds on the other, but it's very contextual dependent.
Right. Maybe one more question for you, if you don't mind. You've made a few references to how the field has evolved over the years. That I think you said something like you've been learning as you go and you're seeing your colleagues sort of still stuck in old paradigms. I wonder how you would just sort of describe that trajectory and where you see it going in the coming years.
Yeah, so I think the you know, even as you say that back to me, I noticed a stinging experience in my body because you're relaying back to me my own judgments, which is not fun to hear. Whereas if you're in a mindfulness practice, hopefully you can relate. It's like, oh, goodness, that doesn't sound good. So I think firstly, the broader field has matured hugely because there's now a connection between behaviors, mindsets. This is the broader field of, you know, development in corporations. Like there's an understanding now. No one's arguing that leaders make a difference, for example, that behaviors make a difference. That's become very established over time. We've seen mindfulness change as well. Like, so people are very accepting now of mindfulness because it's all based in science. You know, science is our God, right? Research is our God in the Western culture. And so that's now firmly in place. What we see emerge, which is very interesting, that sort of where's the cutting edge emergence at the moment? It's in the field of, I think, it's called adult development. So what's becoming progressively more interesting in this development field is this idea of maturity. And so for example, if we take the simple question, if you took two people and they were faced with a dilemma, they had to tell their boss the truth about a mistake and they made, and one would say, these equal intelligence, equal in life positions, one would tell the boss that they made the mistake, another one would cover it up. The question would be, I'm just using a hypothetical example, why? What's the viewpoint on life, the operating system, the value set that's driving the one that would tell the truth and the one that's not? And adult development's really interesting because it's itself is a very new field. It's typically based on two bodies of work, a woman by the name of Suzanne Cook-Greuter at Harvard and another guy, Robert Keegan from Harvard. And they were asking this question, it's like if you had two 40-year-olds and one seems more mature than the other, what makes that person more mature? What is maturity? Anyway, what makes someone more adult than another? And it turns out that the key mechanism for adult development is what's called subject-object theory. Mm-hmm. So what makes someone more mature than another is that they can see more of themselves objectively than the other and not be subject to the forces of, if we take mindfulness practice, of fear, of greed, of clinging, of things that don't serve them. They can watch them and see. And the classic example we use in organizations is approval. So we all need approval, right? It's tribal in us. It's brain deep, if you will. But some people will sacrifice honesty for approval, right? To look good, to be liked. They won't tell the truth. And some people won't. They'll tell the truth even at the risk. Long term, the person who tells the truth ends up being more liked, ironically. They'd be more respected, you know, more trusted. So it's like this short-term focus on getting your kick of being approved of. But over time, you sacrifice all kinds of things, personal well-being, et cetera, et cetera. And in adult development theory, what's going on for the more mature person, the person following the values, is they're able to see and feel the grabbing, the longing for approval, the about to reach for approval, the about to lie. They can see it and not be ruled by it. That means they're more mature. So you can see something in yourself, and your work, no doubt, Joe, focuses on this massively, right? Interoception, being able to see what's going on in yourself and not be ruled by it, and being able to have freedom to choose differently. In a nutshell, that's what maturity is in the adult development field. And it's also, and that's where the beautiful work is, because the more mature a person is, the more they can handle paradoxes and polarities. So if we take, for example, this Black Lives Matter movement at the moment, it's really interesting watching the polarities in the field. Like some people, you know, like the ones who believe they're right. And there doesn't seem to be the ability to hear the other person's perspective with any compassion. Mm-hmm. Ironically, the more mature you are, the more you can hold those other views. You can hold the complexity and not be overwhelmed by it all. So you're able to see things and not be ruled by them, not be ruled by your need to be right, for example. And that would be very helpful in this current situation, because it gets you out of the blame game. What's particularly groundbreaking, and what we're working on at the moment, which we think is going to change the field of adult development, is subject-object theory. In other words, not being ruled by something, being able to see it and then make better choices, is fundamentally insight-based mindfulness 101. Right. At the moment, adult development as a field doesn't include mindfulness, which is kind of astonishing to me, because mindfulness is the core mechanism of growth.
It's the how
of how do you grow? Well, you begin to see it in the body. Remember, we talked about the awareness in the body, in the mind, in the attitude. And in seeing it, awaring it, there's the possibility of questioning it. Is this healthy for me? And then there's the possibility of different choice. Without seeing it, adult development, the whole field of adult development, is a little bit hamstrung in a way. Yeah. It's like they're learning to swim, but they haven't got the water yet.
It's super interesting and makes so much sense. I'd be really curious to see how that work evolves in the coming months and years. You mentioned BLM, and it's obviously very topical these days, and makes me wonder about the maturity level on social media. I asked you this earlier, we got sidetracked, which is great, but I wanted to come back to it. Like, what are you seeing now, how all of this is evolving or being sidetracked or not, with people working from home in the pandemic and stuff? I know I've done a few workshops in the last few months, and what I'm getting is just like really basic stuff being complicated, like, you know, leaders, you know, trying to do their work at the breakfast table with the kids running around. And that must just make this whole thing so much more complex. And I'm wondering, like, what you're seeing there and how you're supporting the leaders that you're working with in this new and really destabilizing environment.
Yeah. It's just a couple of things for us. And I really don't want to sound like we know what we're doing ourselves, because, you know, as soon as you asked me that question, I noticed anxiety rising in my body. It's like, oh, I'm supposed to be an expert. How am I going to answer that one?
Right.
But,
I had a similar anxiety when I was doing the workshop myself, or the workshops that I've done.
Right, yeah. So I think that there's been two workshops I've been asked to run, and it's really anecdotal, so it's not trend-worthy, but... one was just helping leaders with the skill of compassionately connecting with their people virtually, because there's such a deep disconnect in the virtual world and there's so much private suffering going on. So being able to recover or create human connection. So we spend a lot of time with empathy skills, learning empathy skills, helping them understand the difference between sympathy and empathy. And because we've got a whole program on that. So that's the one, we've been asked that several times. And then the other one, which I find fascinating, this is just clients reporting back to us, is that the gift of this process is that it's broken down the walls of personal life to business life, and it's opened up more authentic conversations. So we seem to be seeing a split experience. Like some people are going, wow, this has really broken down the barriers, and we're now showing up much more human with each other. And other people are going, geez, it's so disconnected. How do I create warmth and connection in my team?
That resonates a lot with what my experience has been. I want to throw another one at you here. What comes across, and this might be more to do with the fact that I do some leadership work, but it tends to be more broadly across organizations. I keep encountering this experience of like, oh my God, I really needed that. And I just feel so much more calm now. And this sort of like, sometimes the relaxation or just like the checking in or the grounding, something that people seem to be really craving and really now more than ever. And I really appreciate your comments earlier that's not the outcome that we're going for. That's not right. It needs to be more developmental oriented or insight oriented. Yeah. But so much of the time, people just seem starved for a moment of peace and quiet to sort of gather themselves.
Yeah.
Wondering how you navigate that when you have sort of like you have level 2 and 3 and 4 like or the next priorities to get to, but people are just like trying to drink this from a fire hose because they're so thirsty for it.
Yeah. So I don't tend to give simple answers, but one of the things that about the calming practice. So firstly, to your experience, the great beauty we've seen of mindfulness practice, and I've had the privilege of working with sort of Nobel Prize winning scientists level, right, on this stuff who are academically trained to tear everything to pieces. And watching the mindfulness logic and practice, you know, so one of their questions is, why would you ever stop thinking? Like that's the height of stupidity, right? Kind of questions like that. And seeing how much those people have all fallen in love with mindfulness has been very beautiful. So, and we've seen people have come to us regularly and said, from the minute you introduced mindfulness, my comment in my mind was, this mindfulness bullshit. Like, here we go again. And by the end of the day, or, you know, sometimes there's immersions of 4 or 5 days, they're like, oh, I'm like a super believer. We've had people who've become top 100 users on our app. You know, we've got hundreds of thousands of people in there. The top 100 users who started a program and like a raving cynic. So it gives you a lot of confidence that this practice is logical. It can stand up to the most, you know, smartest cynical minds on earth. Mm-hmm. The one challenge we have is that, to your point about the little island of calmness in the middle of the day is valuable, but I have a very cynical view of it because it's like it's like taking a break from drinking alcohol and then enjoying that little break, but then you go back to drinking alcohol. Of what real use is it? You might go, oh, that's good, which is why we have so much focus on the why. Like, if I can answer the why, like, what's this life about for me? Is it about chasing those goals? Or is it about, and what am I doing? It's more like your ACT principles. It's a deeper look. And I did a 45-minute webinar on mindfulness with a client last week, Friday. And I'm finding myself more and more emphasizing this point, that the calmness is as much good and a balm as is also as much about addiction withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
The moment you begin, you might have a moment of honeymoon when you're in the company of a good mindfulness teacher because they carry so much calm presence themselves, and you're being supported by that in that moment, and it's really restful with them. But then you're on your own and you try and do 30 seconds of calmness and you just feel like crap in that 30 seconds. I'm very sensitive to the idea of mindfulness being sold as like a balm or like a cream that you put on your itchy skin, you know, because I think it's as much calming as it is dealing with addiction. So as soon as if you don't look at the emails for 5 minutes, where you're used to looking at the emails and that's the way you get your dopamine kick and so on and so on, and you stop and you spend 5 minutes just following the breath, unless you're from another planet, you're not going to have 5 minutes of perfect bliss. You're also, you might have moments of calm, but you're also going to have itchiness cold turkey feelings. You're going to have difficult feelings in those 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And learning about those and staying steady in those mm-hmm. is so important. So mindfulness is both gift and challenge at the same time, even yeah. in those calm moments. And we're very careful now when we present mindfulness. And we even inquire. So when we do, like we do a 2 minute practice, 10 years ago, I would have just looked for people who have had the experience. Oh yeah, I really feel calm and good. Yeah. Great. Yeah. It worked. Now yeah. I don't do that anymore. Now I'll go, okay, you've got that. Great. Now, can anyone also report like the challenge of this? And then we become really interested in that too. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. That, you know, as soon as we stay still for 2 or 3 minutes, our usual addictions, we start experiencing the yeah. absence of those addictions. We start going into cold turkey already. Wow, that's interesting. And what happens yeah. if you can't tolerate that cold turkey? And then it becomes very developmental in its conversation style.
Yeah, so I understand now the emphasis on the why, like really getting that right up front with yeah. with the client, because yeah. otherwise it gets very confusing. And most people come to the practice with an expectation that it's going to be calming, because yeah. that's what we see in various media and stuff.
Yes.
And then I can be a little bit reluctant or scared about poking for the sort of the deeper questions.
Yes.
Many people don't even necessarily want to go there. But, no. you know, in a little lunch and learn, people, like, I want to deliver an experience that people are going to remember and that'll yeah. be meaningful to them. So I guess as I get more mature as a teacher, I'm able to tease enough of these sort of deeper questions. But yeah. it's not always, as we said earlier, it's not always landing on fertile ground.
Yes, and I think, but those of us in the field of mindfulness, I think if we don't, I'll just talk for myself. I've come to the understanding that if I don't touch on that, we're learning mindfulness practices as much for calmness as dealing with our patterns of behavior that are not serving us, and those are addictions, and with there are addictions and aversions in there, and that you'll experience that really quickly. So mm-hmm. even, you know, you might get nice calm meditation, and the fourth meditation is a mess. Mm-hmm. I think I've come to the realization if I don't speak about that up front, I'm out of integrity. It's false advertising.
Right.
It's literally false advertising. It's like, practice mindfulness and all be calm and well. No. But the beauty of it is that when you are able to stay present and non-reactive with uncomfortable, itchy, difficult feelings, you're growing as a human being. You're learning to navigate really important emotions. Mm-hmm. And these will serve you. So like that 2 minutes of agony sitting down and like, why the hell am I doing this? This is why you're doing this. You know, so that the next time, I remember the biggest gift of all for me was when I sat down for a day and a half and basically watched my father die. Mm-hmm. And I was able to stay present in the agony of it and deeply connected. And it was an extremely sacred experience mm-hmm. because over the years, it was really evident to me, the years of training myself to be present and balanced within pain allowed me to stay connected, allowed me to be compassionate, allowed me to be balanced. That was priceless, that gift. I watched people around me who had not have a practice, who were drinking, going and getting a drink, joking around. They lost the sacredness of the experience and the healing available there. And I think the more we can learn that life is not just, you know, that mindfulness is not the promise of pretty roses all the time. Mindfulness is the promise of growing as a human being and coming to balance with life's pain and life's instability. And there's a grace in it. And to me, that's just so much more beautiful than a bit of calmness.
Hmm. You're preaching to the choir here. I'm with you 100%. Thank you for that. We're well over time here, and I should probably let you get back to your work day. Really appreciate you taking the time today, Michael. And the conversation was every bit as rich and interesting as I was hoping it would be. So thanks for that too. And I really hope we can do this again, because I feel like I'm just kind of scratching the surface with you. So yeah.
So Joe, I just want to I just want to thank you, and I just want to, and especially for your listeners, I just wanted to compliment you because you're a very expert in this field, and yet you hold the questions and you don't interrupt. You hold the questions like you don't know when there's many of the times you do know. And I just wanted to really express my admiration and appreciation for that quality you held in this interview.
Oh, thanks a lot. That's very kind. I really appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for everyone for listening.
All right, Michael, take care. And we'll do this again sometime soon.
Yeah, cool. Thank you. Enjoy your Sunday evening and good sleep.
Thanks. Wow.
Thanks for listening to the Mindspace podcast. I hope it was inspiring. If you feel the world could use a little more Mindspace, please consider supporting the podcast. The best way to do that is to leave a review on the Apple Podcast app or wherever you listen, or share your favorite episode on social media. Thanks and be well.